Undoubtedly, hair loss in women can be a vexing and anxiety-provoking experience. In this dialogue, Dr. Rhonda Klein and Dr. Jerry Shapiro discuss the subject of alopecia in women, a topic of concern to dermatologists and an estimated 21 million women who suffer from alopecia in the USA.
This is Rhonda Klein. I'm here today with Dr. Jerry Shapiro, and we are going to be speaking about alopecia in women, specifically discussing alopecia areata and some of the cicatricial alopecias. So welcome, Dr. Shapiro.
It's a pleasure.
Before we begin discussing the treatments, I just wanted to touch on how you generally start with your workup of alopecia in general.
For women, alopecia can certainly be a very daunting predicament because there are so many things in the differential diagnosis. So we have to do a complete history and a complete physical examination of the scalp, and then we then decide what the diagnosis is. But in terms of treatments, and all of this will be geared by what the diagnosis is. Now, with women, you really need to be a detective to really decide what the final diagnosis is. The non-scarring hair loss, it could be androgenetic alopecia, could be a telogen effluvium on top of androgenetic alopecia, unmasking androgenetic, could be diffuse alopecia areata. So you have to ask the right questions to really come up with some kind of diagnosis and then do the appropriate physical exam looking for signs of inflammation, signs of any kind of scaling / hyperkeratosis that will also clue you into the diagnosis.
Of course. So in terms of alopecia areata, do you routinely perform any laboratory analyses?
For non-scarring alopecias, if it was more of a diffuse hair loss, I do. They're my four basic tests that I order for non-scarring hair loss that isn't alopecia areata, and that would be a TSH, ferritin, zinc, and vitamin D. However, for alopecia areata, I order nothing. If the diagnosis is very clear, I will order nothing as long as the functional inquiry is negative for any signs of hyper or hypothyroidism. If the functional inquiry is positive, I will then order tests for thyroid function, but otherwise I will not.
And do you routinely biopsy a patient that you suspect alopecia areata, or you just rely on your clinical diagnosis?
It's extremely rare that I would biopsy alopecia areata. The diagnosis usually is very clear. However, there are forms of diffuse alopecia areata that I cannot differentiate from telogen effluvium that I would have to diagnose. When you are biopsying non-scarring alopecia, I would strongly recommend transverse sections, as you get a lot more follicles in every section, and then you can really make a more accurate diagnosis. But I do not biopsy routinely alopecia areata at all, unless it's a little confusing with a telogen effluvium, a diffuse AA and telogen effluvium.
Now, in terms of the cicatricial alopecias, what is your standard workup comprised of in terms of laboratory and biopsy techniques?
Well, the most important thing to do in cicatricial alopecia is to do a biopsy. And then I will base what laboratory tests I do on the biopsy report. If it turns out to be lupus erythematosus, then I'll work up the patient to make sure that they don't have any signs or any serology for systemic lupus. But for regular lichen planopilaris, I don't order anything. And for folliculitis decalvans, for that I will do a culture. I'll take one of the pustules, open it up, and then I'll do a culture, but that's all I'll do.
Okay, great. And do you routinely do one or two biopsies for scarring alopecias?
If I suspect that it's going to be lupus erythematosus, then I will do a biopsy for direct immunofluorescence, but that's a very small biopsy, just a 2-millimeter punch. And then I will also do one for transverse sectioning and one for vertical sectioning. I like to have both for scarring hair loss. Now, if it's non-lupus, if I think it's lichen planopilaris, then I would like two biopsies, one for transverse sectioning and one for longitudinal sectioning.
Great. That was a perfect overview of the workup for some of our more common alopecias. Moving into treatment a little bit, why don't we start with alopecia areata and maybe go through your treatment regimen a little bit. I'm sure you have a ladder that you work off of.
Yes, we have a tiered approach to how we approach alopecia areata based on the age of the patient and the extent of scalp involvement. Now, we'll just talk about scalp. I'm not going to talk about eyebrows right now or beard or anything like that. So for a scalp alopecia areata, we decide whether we're dealing with a pediatric, whether it's basically a child under 10 years old versus someone over 10 years old. If they're under 10 years old, I really don't feel like doing injections or anything like that. So what we'll use usually is 5% minoxidil solution twice a day. And then I seal that in with a mometasone cream twice a day. And I try to encourage the patient, if it depends on how extensive it is, but if it's quite extensive, to just treat half the scalp. And then I'll see if the treatment's actually doing the trick or not. Many parents don't want to do that. They want to treat the whole thing. So we treat the whole thing and we just monitor it. You won't see results for probably 3 months because it takes time for these things to kick in. I will also use anthralin in the pediatric population as well. I'll use anthralin 1% cream, and what we'll do is apply it for 10 minutes daily and then gradually increase up to 1 hour. I do not treat children usually under 5 years old. I feel very uncomfortable doing this because then we're treating the parents and we're not really treating the child because the child really doesn't care about their alopecia areata. So I try to discourage in the really young population any kind of treatment. But once they hit 6 or 7, they're bullying in school and all this. So I think it behooves us to be more aggressive. And that's my treatment approach for children. For adults, I divide patients into those with less than 50% versus more than 50% scalp involvement. If there's less than 50%, I usually do intralesional corticosteroid injection, triamcinolone acetonide, and I usually use 5 milligrams per cc for a total of 4 cc, so a total of only 20 milligrams per month. And we injected 40 tiny injections of 0.1 cc each, and we spread it around. If they don't have that much scalp involvement, you don't necessarily have to use 4 cc's. This is the maximum volume that I'll use at that concentration. If it's very extensive, we might even go to 2.5 milligrams per cc and do 8 cc's and do 80 tiny injections if the patient can tolerate this kind of thing, if it's very, very extensive. I use that in conjunction with clobetasol. It depends on how much hair they have. I can use the cream very nicely if they don't have that much hair, or I'll use a lotion if they have hair. And so I like a super potent class 1 topical corticosteroid, and I'll also use it with topical minoxidil, 5% solution. This is their home treatment, and then they come to the doctor's office every 4 to 6 weeks for their injections.
And you have the patients apply the minoxidil and then the clobetasol immediately following it?
Yes, especially if it's a cream, because I think the cream helps to seal in the minoxidil. If I'm just using the lotion, I don't think it really matters which one you put on first. I just ask them to layer one on top of the other. That's how I treat less than 50% scalp involvement. I mean, we may also use anthralin if that doesn't work as well. More than 50% scalp involvement, I'll use topical immunotherapy. And my first choice is difenciprone, but other people can use squaric acid W ester, which is excellent as well. I just am used to difenciprone, but squaric acid W ester is wonderful as well. And we usually sensitize with a 2% solution on an area that's around 2 to 3 cc's on the scalp. We do not sensitize on the arm, as some people do. We sensitize directly on the scalp where we want the hair. And then we will subsequently treat the following week, once the patient has been sensitized, with 0.001%. And we'll only treat half the scalp. And because I really want to make sure when I'm using this agent that it's the drug that's actually making the difference rather than just spontaneous resolution of the condition, which frequently happens in alopecia areata. And so we'll just treat half the scalp. They come once a week. And what I aim for is a low-grade tolerable eczema. I don't want no reaction because that's obviously useless. You want some kind of reaction, but you don't want too much of an eczema because then it's unbearable for the patient and you may end up with some scarring if it's too much. So what you do is you titrate it and you find out what the best concentration is for that patient. It frequently is 0.1 or 1, but everybody's different. Sometimes 0.001 is what you have to use for maintenance, or even 0.001 0001 in some people. And they come every week for the treatment. I do not give it to the patient to take home. It is not FDA approved. Patients have to sign some kind of informed consent saying that they understand that this is not FDA approved, because you can end up with some really bad eczematous dermatitis, and you really want to make sure that the patient understands this. And when before I start treatment, I counsel the patient about all the side effects, which include eczema, hyper and hypopigmentation, and lymphadenopathy. And I show them pictures of this as well, so that they have some idea of what can happen. And once they understand, and I feel that they understand, then I'll ask them to sign the informed consent, and we can go ahead with the treatment. We usually see results in 3 to 6 months. If the patient has not responded by around 9 months, I just say, well, probably they don't respond. I may switch over to SADB or squaric acid dibutyl ester, and that may work in a difenciprone non-responsive individuals, but I've not found that there are that many cases. If they haven't responded to one, they probably won't respond to the other.
Do you ever use systemic steroids or cyclosporin or biologics in these treatment-resistant patients?
First of all, I don't think that biologics work at this time. Maybe the future ones will work, but the ones we presently have available for psoriasis, I've not found them useful. Now, when it comes to systemic agents, I do use systemic steroids, but not that frequently. Because when you stop the systemic steroids, the hair falls out, unless they've gone into remission anyway. And you don't want to get a patient addicted to the steroids. You may not be able to get under a certain level of steroids, and you have to keep them on it for a long time. They may end up with serious side effects. And it's not a good idea, because long-term steroids is not a good idea for this kind of problem. Cyclosporin I have used, and it definitely works. The problem with cyclosporin is, again, you have to get them off of it. And when you get them off of it, the hair falls out. And the cases that I've put on, some have gotten some side effects, such as liver function test abnormalities, high cholesterol, and some renal problems. So it's not my first line at all. I have used methotrexate. And I think that really helps, especially for eyebrow alopecia areata. I found that eyebrows seem to be very responsive to methotrexate. But I haven't yet had a patient at 25 milligrams a week. I use a higher dose than psoriasis. I have not yet seen anyone really grow a great head of hair from methotrexate.
Is there a role for eczema laser or photodynamic therapy, PUVA, in treatment of alopecia areata?
Okay, first let's talk about the eczema 308 nanometer laser. Yes, I think it does work in non-totalis universalis. I have not personally used it because we don't have that device in where I work. And as a result, yeah, I don't have access to it, but the papers that have been published show that it does have 41% efficacy. So I think for non-totalis universalis, it's worth a try. Photodynamic therapy with ALA, I have used. We've done a study on it, and it did not work. We also used it in animals, and it didn't seem to work as well. Animal models, rodents. And in terms of PUVA, that does work, but again, you end up with the problem of having to keep these patients on PUVA for long periods of time. The cumulative dose gets higher and higher with every treatment, and they end up getting a lot of PUVA, and you're always worried about skin cancers, of course, with PUVA, squamous cell carcinoma, basal cell carcinoma, and even melanoma. And so you really have to be careful when you're treating with PUVA, because it's hard to get the patient off. They get addicted to it because they know it's working. And I'd say it works in around 40% of people. And so, but the problem is trying to get them off of it. So I don't use it that much. We did a study with narrowband UVB, and it didn't show benefit. So I don't think narrowband UVB has a role at this point.
And then how often do you use topical tazarotene or topical tacrolimus or pimecrolimus as steroid-sparing agents?
I've used them. I do not think they work. I do not think they will penetrate deep enough, at least when it comes to tacrolimus and pimecrolimus. I don't think it's they penetrate deep enough for it to have any effect. Tazarotene I've used. It was not effective. Maybe I didn't use it for long enough, whatever, but I've not found it to be useful in my clinic.
And then for burnt out alopecia areata, is there any role for hair transplantation?
If someone has very stable alopecia areata and they have a donor area that is well camouflaged, you can try it. There are reports in the literature. I'm very reluctant to do it. I do hair transplants as well in our clinic, but not for alopecia areata. I'd be reluctant to do it because I'm worried that I'll exacerbate the condition or the hairs won't take. But there are reports in the literature that have been published where it was successful and it even grew more hair than from the grafts alone. It somehow stimulated other hairs to grow. And as in when you transplant vitiligo, that the vitiligo areas around the transplanted areas start pigmenting. So there is some case reports of that, but I'm reluctant to do it.
Great. So if we move on now into the scarring alopecias, perhaps we can start with lupus and you can give us your treatment regimen.
Okay. For lupus, my treatment regimen depends again on the age of the patient. If we're dealing with a pediatric population, which it's not that common to get lupus of the scalp then, or the adults. Let's just talk about the adults. I use triamcinolone acetonide. 10 milligrams per cc for a total of 2 cc, so 20 injections, where they have the condition. I'll also use clobetasol lotion to be applied twice a day. And we'll see what kind of response we get to that. But if they're very symptomatic, it's very extensive, I use systemic therapy. And we may, if it's very rapidly developing and very symptomatic, we'll put patients on prednisone, usually 40 milligrams a day, tapered over 8 weeks. We'll also put them on Plaquenil, 200 milligrams twice a day. It takes around 8 weeks for Plaquenil to kick in. And so it's good to bridge it with prednisone. So we'll try that regimen first. And we've actually reversed. Usually we think of the scarring alopecias to be irreversible. But if you get lupus really early, you can reverse it. And we've done that and published on that. So I think it's important to treat aggressively early cicatricial alopecia because it truly is a trichologic emergency. Because once the hair is gone, it may be gone if you don't get it soon enough. So try to treat as soon as possible. Now, if those treatments don't work, there are other options you can try systemically on these patients, such as methotrexate. You can try Imuran. You can try mycophenolate mofetil as well. I use that more for lichen planopilaris, but that would be the options for lupus.
In terms of lichen planopilaris, before moving on to the mycophenolate mofetil, do you generally start with antimalarials?
Okay, for lichen planopilaris, if I'm going for a systemic agent based on extent of involvement and symptomatic, whether they have a lot of itch burning, because some of these people have so much itch and burning, they can't sleep. Again, I'll try prednisone as well. I also, frequently, first-line therapy is one of the tetracyclines, doxycycline, 100 milligrams twice a day. And I'll use that because that hardly has any side effects. And then if that doesn't work, then we'll go for Plaquenil, or I'll add Plaquenil with the doxycycline. You can use tetracyclines with Plaquenil together. And if that doesn't work, then I go for mycophenolate mofetil. We usually start at 500 milligrams twice a day for the first month and then go to 1,000 milligrams twice a day.
At what point do you use retinoids or methotrexate in the treatment of
if mycophenolate mofetil doesn't work?
Okay. And obviously, retinoids, methotrexate, even mycophenolate mofetil at times can cause alopecia. How do you counsel your patients on that side effect and how do you...
Well, usually if they get alopecia from mycophenolate mofetil, it's going to be a more of a telogen effluvium. And so I warn them that there is this small chance they could end up with a different kind of alopecia. The chances are low, but it's there and they have to be warned.
And then in terms of the more neutrophilic cicatricial alopecia, such as folliculitis decalvans or dissecting cellulitis, do you generally start with an oral antibiotic or isotretinoin? What is your treatment paradigm?
It depends on the diagnosis. If it's folliculitis decalvans, I'll start more with antibiotics, again, the tetracyclines or Keflex, or those are my top two. Then I might use rifampin, 300 milligrams twice a day, with clindamycin, 300 milligrams twice twice a day. So I'll use more the antibiotic route. If that doesn't work, then retinoids is certainly an option. So is Dapsone as well. For dissecting cellulitis, I'll start off with Accutane right away. And we usually use 80 milligrams to 120 milligrams daily. We go to higher doses than what we might use for acne. And they have to be on it for prolonged period of time.
So more than 6 months more generally?
Yes, because when you stop it too early, the condition frequently comes back. May come back anyway, but your remission period is longer, the longer you put them on it.
And do you use topical antibiotics with the isotretinoin?
I do. I use Eupirocin cream. Definitely I'll add in the mix. And I also inject these patients as well. If somebody has really severe dissecting cellulitis, I'll have to drain some of these big cysts that they have.
And at what point do you explore surgical options for dissecting cellulitis? More excisions below the
hair? Well, once the condition has been stabilized, then we will go for excisions, okay? So, I mean, when it's very active, drain it, we'll lance and drain type of thing, and then I try to get this thing settled before I actually excise any of these things out.
So just any last minute thoughts for our listeners on just guidance of the treatment of alopecia?
I just want to say that alopecia takes time in an office, and you really have to spend quite a lot of time with the patient. Psychologically, it's very difficult, especially for a woman who's losing their hair, to accept this. And so my visits, for instance, my New York office have to be at least a half hour to an hour because these patients need a lot of counseling, a lot of hand-holding, and you really have to spend time with your patients. And frequently to make the right diagnosis, you really have to spend a lot of time doing a meticulous history, a meticulous physical examination, and then going through the different treatments and all the side effects. It takes a long time.
Great. Well, on behalf of Dialogues in Dermatology, we want to thank you, Dr. Shapiro, for taking part in our interview today. It was very helpful for our listeners.
My pleasure. Thank you for asking.
Ascertaining the cause of hair loss in female patients can present quite a significant challenge in the office, but physicians should utilize clues to help guide their diagnosis, including a full inquiry of pattern of hair loss, medication conditions, family history, as well as physical examination. Laboratory testing may also aid in the process, but in rare cases, a biopsy may be necessary. As mentioned before, performing a thorough history and physical exam can often guide your diagnosis of alopecia. Four basic laboratory tests which may be helpful for non-scarring hair loss include TSH, ferritin, zinc, and vitamin D. Often treatment of alopecia areata is contingent on a number of factors, including the age of the patient, as well as the extent and duration of scalp involvement. Various treatment modalities include topical steroids, topical immunotherapy, topical minoxidil, anthralin, and immunosuppressants. In many outpatient settings, intralesional and topical corticosteroids are widely used in the treatment of alopecia areata, especially where there is limited involvement. Various concentrations, ranging from 2.5 to 10 milligrams per milliliter, of triamcinolone acetonide are injected into the deep dermal plane, and topical anesthetic cream may be applied before treatment for pain control in pediatric patients. For intralesional corticosteroids, it is recommended that treatment should be stopped if no improvement is seen after 6 months. Topical minoxidil 1%, 3%, 5% formulations may be used either alone or in conjunction with topical corticosteroids. Anthralin 1% cream may be used as short contact therapy, but there are limited case reports that support this treatment, and multiple adverse effects include severe irritation, folliculitis, and staining of the skin. For refractory or severe alopecia areata involving more than 50% of the scalp, topical immunotherapeutic agents such as diphenhydramine and squaric acid dibutyl ester may be used. Neither medication, however, is FDA approved, and adverse events, including marked sensitization reactions, have been documented. For cicatricial or scarring alopecias, the North American Hair Research Society has produced a classification scheme based upon the predominant inflammatory infiltrate detected on scalp biopsy. Thus, cases are classified as lymphocytic, neutrophilic, or mixed. Lymphocytic forms of alopecia include lichen planopilaris, chronic cutaneous lupus erythematosus, and frontal fibrosing alopecia, whereas neutrophilic forms include folliculitis decalvans and dissecting cellulitis of the scalp. For cicatricial alopecias, early treatment is key to managing disease progression. For patients with chronic cutaneous lupus erythematosus, topical or intralesional steroids may be sufficient, but for those with more widespread disease, Plaquenil should be considered. Third-line treatments include azathioprine, methotrexate, and mycophenolate mofetil. For lichen planopilaris, based on the extent of involvement and symptoms, similar treatment with corticosteroids may be utilized. Often, tetracycline antibiotics are first-line therapy, followed by plaquenil and mycophenolate mofetil. Frontal fibrosing alopecia, commonly affecting postmenopausal women, is treated with plaquenil, mycophenolate mofetil, and antiandrogens or calcineurin inhibitors. For neutrophilic forms of alopecia, the treatment regimen is often contingent on the diagnosis. Folliculitis decalvans responds well to antibiotics such as rifampin and clindamycin, but for dissecting cellulitis, the best option may be to start oral isotretinoin immediately. The psychological impact of alopecia is often overlooked, yet the dermatologist has a unique opportunity to play a significant role in counseling the patient about their diagnosis and discussing various treatment options. Next month, we have a special Halloween-themed edition which will feature dialogues about parasitic arthropods, syphilis, fungi, and other fun stuff. Remember, we now have a presence on Facebook, and we'd like you to join us online for previews, info, and fun. This has been Terry Cronin with Dialogues in Dermatology. Keep up all the great work you're doing on behalf of your patients. Your medical and surgical expertise and your continued commitment to your patients is appreciated by your community. Most of all, stay passionate about dermatology and have another great month.